This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The U.S. President Joe Biden and Russian leader Vladimir Putin have held their first conversation as part of a phone call that underscored troubled relations and the delicate balance between the former Cold War foes. According to the White House, Biden raised concerns about the arrest of opposition figure Alexei Navalny, Russia's alleged involvement in a massive cyber espionage campaign, and reports of Russian bounties on American troops in Afghanistan. The Kremlin, meanwhile, focused on Putin's response to Biden's proposal to extend the last remaining U.S.-Russia arms control treaty. The United States is announcing the restoration of relations with the Palestinians. We get more from AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
The Biden administration is restoring relations with the Palestinians and renewing aid to Palestinian refugees. The moves reverse Trump administration policy and signaled the new administration's support for a two-state solution to the decades-old conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians. Acting U.S. Ambassador Richard Mills made the announcement to a high-level virtual meeting of the United Nations Security Council. The Trump administration was heavily pro-Israel, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv and closing the Palestinian Liberation Organization's Washington office in September 2018. Mike Gracia, Washington.
The U.S. Senate has confirmed Antony Blinken to be Secretary of State, paving the way for the Biden administration's eventual reversal of the Trump administration's policies. He was confirmed by a 72-22 vote to serve as the country's top diplomat, filling the most senior cabinet position and one that is fourth in the line of presidential succession. This is VOA News. The World Health Organization issued fresh clinical advice on Tuesday for treating COVID-19 patients, including those displaying persistent symptoms after recovery. It also said it advised using low-dose anticoagulants to prevent blood clots. The WHO advised clinicians to put patients into the awake, a prone position on their front, shown to improve the oxygen flow level. The WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris told a UN briefing in Geneva that a WHO-led team of independent experts currently in the central Chinese city of Wuhan, where the first human cases were detected in December of 2019, is due to leave quarantine in the next 2 days to pursue its work with Chinese researchers on the virus origins. She declined to comment on reports of delays in rollout of vaccines in the European Union. She said she had no specific data, and the WHO's priority was for health workers in all countries to be vaccinated in the first 100 days of the year. U.S. President Joe Biden says the U.S. is ramping up vaccine deliveries to hard-pressed states over the next 3 weeks and expects to provide enough doses to vaccinate 300 million Americans by the end of the summer or early fall. He's calling for a push wartime effort. He said that Tuesday that his administration is in fact working to buy an additional 100 million doses of the two approved coronavirus vaccines. And he acknowledged that states in recent weeks have been left guessing how much vaccine they will have from 1 week to the next. He called that unacceptable and said lives are at stake. Britain's health department reported Tuesday the nation's death toll from COVID-19 has surpassed 100,000 people. In a televised news briefing from its office, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said it's hard to compute the sorrow contained in that grim statistic. The years of lives lost, the family gatherings not attended, and for so many relatives, a missed chance even to say goodbye. The health department said more than 100,000 Britons have died within 28 days of a positive COVID-19 test. The government figures show Britain has the fifth highest death toll globally and reported a further 1,631 deaths and more than 20,000 cases on Tuesday alone. Meanwhile, Britain is speeding up its vaccine distribution with more than 6.8 million people receiving their first dose of vaccine and more than 472,000 receiving both doses as of Monday. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Wednesday, January 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's service chiefs resign.
The information we put out is that the president has accepted their resignation. So therefore, their retirement from service takes effect immediately.
We'll get reaction from the opposition PDP. Liberia condemns scourge of piracy and kidnapping in the Gulf of Guinea. Malawi's former president welcomes the Biden administration and criticizes his successor. The UN gears up to help tens of thousands of Mozambicans battered by Cyclone Eloise. And Uganda's opposition leader, Bobby Wine, is free from house arrest.
Where you are seated right now, there were tents of soldiers. They jumped over the fence and took over our compound. All I can say is that we are here and we are not giving up.
Somali journalists are worried about arrest ahead of elections. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's entire service chiefs, including the Army, Navy, and Air Force, resigned and retired effectively yesterday, Tuesday. They were appointed by President Muhammadu Buhari after he was elected to his first term in 2015. There have been increasing demands in recent years for the service chiefs' replacement as the security crisis in Nigeria worsened. President Buhari immediately accepted the resignation and announced their replacement. Garba Shehu is a senior special assistant on media and publicity to President Buhari. He says the outgoing service chiefs serve their country well.
The president has accepted the immediate resignation of the service chiefs, and he has appointed new ones to replace them.
Did they resign or did the president fire them?
The information we put out is that the president has accepted their resignation. So therefore, their retirement from service takes effect immediately.
As you know, the opposition has been calling for the sacking of these service chiefs. By their resignation, is this an admission, according to the opposition, that they have been ineffective in dealing with the security crisis?
Most of the comments by the opposition are ill-informed for two reasons. The appointment of the service chiefs is not tenured. They are not bound by time. They serve at the pleasure of the president. For as long as they retain his confidence, he has confidence in them, they will continue to serve. But more than any other thing, the president, as commander-in-chief of the country's armed forces, the enormous amount of information and intelligence available to him is not available to any individual, including those leaders of the opposition. So in effect, there are things he sees that they don't see. So Nigerians are just impatient, and we hope that they will give this new set of leaders the benefit of the doubt. Let them be allowed to serve without any distractions.
I was reading, Shehu, an Igbo chief, saying that the Igbos have been excluded in the appointment of the new chiefs. Any comment?
This country has more than 250 ethnic groups. If you are going to appoint a service chief for each of the ethnic groups, you are going to have more than 250. The country's heads of army, air force, or police are appointed on the basis of merit. They're not appointed on the basis of tribe or ethnic origin or religion, for that matter.
The appointment of the new service chiefs, what would that mean now in terms of trying to continue what people have been saying about insecurity in the country?
Well, we hope that Nigerians will give them the space, the room they need in order to serve this country and to discharge their duty to the Constitution and to the nation. It's a new page, and we are hoping that they will use a new set of eyes to look at the existing problems and possibly bring solutions that are new, that have not been tried before in dealing with the ongoing situation. But it must be said, the ones who just left have done the best anybody could do for this country. Never in the history of this country have we seen heads of the army and air force being physically there at the war front, as these ones that just left were doing. They fought alongside the soldiers. It's unprecedented, but Nigerians are very difficult to satisfy.
Garba Shehu is a senior special assistant on media and publicity to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, the PDP, says the resignation yesterday of the country's service chiefs came a little too late. PDP National Publicity Secretary Kola Ologbandiya says the opposition party had been calling for the removal of the service chiefs for a long time in the face of the Buhari administration's failure to rein in Boko Haram, murderers, herdsmen, bandits, and kidnappers.
Our reaction, foremostly, is that the service chiefs resigned based on the demand of the People's Democratic Party and other eminent Nigerians who told them clearly that even if President Muhammadu Buhari refused to ask them to go, they should resign in the interest of our nation, Nigeria. But having said that, even if their departure was predicated on the sack by President Muhammadu Buhari, our party consider the decision as rather late, and it is carried out after so much harm had already been done to our national security.
A spokesperson for President Buhari has praised the outgoing service chiefs that they have done their best in trying to deal with the security crisis in the country.
Well, what he considers as their best is the worst in the security history of our nation. And it also showed that President Muhammadu Buhari has consistently refused to heed the wise counsel by well-meaning Nigerians who continually ask him to excuse the service chiefs.
What is the PDP's view on the new service chiefs?
Well, for us in the People's Democratic Party, we have hope that the new service chiefs will brace up to the challenges of our nation, and that the appointment at this time, more than any other appointment in the history of our nation in respect of security, has conferred on them a huge sense of commitment. They need to be responsible in their offices and a determination to secure our nation in order to restore peace, orderliness, and national cohesiveness in our polity.
The Minister of Information, Lai Mohammed, yesterday said that the security situation in the country was far better than when President Buhari first came to power. Your comment?
The decision today, either by the resignation of the service chief or by the sack by President Muhammadu Buhari, has poo-pooed the position of Alhaji Lai Mohammed, the Minister of Information, that the security of our nation is better today than it was in 2015.
Kola Ologbandiya is the National Publicity Secretary of Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. The Liberian government has condemned what it calls growing scourge of piracy and kidnapping in the Gulf of Guinea and called for multilateral action to stem the threat. The condemnation follows last Saturday's kidnapping by armed pirates of 15 sailors from a Turkish container ship off the coast of Nigeria. One sailor was killed. The International Maritime Bureau says pirates in the Gulf of Guinea kidnapped 130 sailors in 22 incidents last year. Eugene Nabe is commissioner of the Liberian Maritime Authority and former information minister. He says Liberia, as the flag state of the Turkish vessel, has initiated an investigation in line with United Nations law of the sea. Nabe calls for international action to stop piracy in the Gulf of Guinea.
Firstly, we are very concerned about this growing scourge of piracy in the Gulf of Guinea. It's not just affecting Liberian flag vessels, but also many other vessels flying the region. You know, it is very disturbing. And we have elevated this matter to the regional level, at the ECOWAS level. In fact, at the last ECOWAS Heads of State Summit, President Weah also raised the issue of insecurity generally, and the issue of piracy in the region. So Liberia, we've sent out our condolences to the people of Azerbaijan, because one of the sailors who was killed in this attack is an Azerbaijani citizen. And currently, there are about 14 Turkish citizens who are still in captivity, who have been held hostage by these pirates. And I can assure you, James, that Liberia will leave no stone unturned to ensure that shipping can ply the Gulf of Guinea without being invaded by these pirates.
Mr. Commissioner, these ships are flying Liberian flag. Whose responsibility to provide protection for them?
Well, as the flag state, we do have some responsibility. Also, the country of origin, the country of ownership. So what we are doing is that we recognize that this has to be a collective effort on the part of all involved. Ships that ply the high seas do so with the understanding that there will be guaranteed protection, not just by the flag state, but also by the port state and also by those who like ECOWAS that have jurisdiction over our various waters. So what we are proposing as a country is for us to combine our efforts. All of the countries around the Gulf of Guinea should work together and ensure that we have full security. So Liberia is proposing that we look at the possibility of having armed guards on the ships. Also, we have to deal with the issue of onshore activities because these pirates, they have to come from somewhere to be able to go on the high seas to carry out their nefarious acts.
I know Liberia has depended on its maritime system. What does this mean now in terms of economic support for Liberia because of these attacks? Do they impact your source of revenue?
Definitely. The impact on the image of our country and the image of our registry as the second largest shipping nation in the world, we pride ourselves on quality of service for our clients. Now, with the continuous piracy situation in the Gulf of Guinea, where a lot of Liberian flag vessels transact their business, this is a matter that is very concerning and grave. And this is why we have elevated this to the heads of state level. And we believe that some resolution can be found if we work together on various levels, bilaterally and at the multilateral level.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's former information minister and now commissioner of the Liberia Maritime Authority. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, January 27th. Ugandan security forces have ended their de facto house arrest of opposition leader Robert Chakulai, popularly known as Bobi Wine. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Soon after the departure of a joint security force that had blocked access to his home for 12 days, Bobi Wine received visitors Tuesday. They included 61 of the newly elected legislators under the National Unity Platform that he heads. The police armed soldiers withdrew earlier in the day in line with a court order that said authorities should either charge Wine with a crime or let him go free. Wine says his de facto house arrest served to expose the regime that is presiding over Ugandans.
Where you are seated right now, there were tents of soldiers. They jumped over the fence and took over our compound. They could not allow my wife to access our garden. I will not talk so much about the stress and the experience. All I can say is that we are here and we are not giving up. All that stress only made us strong and proved to us that Museveni is so scared of us.
VOA reached out to the Ugandan police and government for comment on Wine's remarks, but got no response. Official election results showed longtime President Yoweri Museveni winning 58% of the vote in last week's election. His National Resistance Movement won an overwhelming majority in parliament in last week's elections, but Wine has rejected the results as fraudulent and declared himself president-elect. The NUP says it has evidence of widespread election irregularities. Museveni has rejected the allegation, calling the election the most cheating-free in Uganda's post-colonial period. Wine said Tuesday the party might go to court to challenge the presidential election outcome, but said more action will be needed to remove Museveni, who he considers illegitimate.
Should we go to court, it should be another front to expose the regime. But most importantly, our energy, our hope, and our power is within the people of Uganda. Mr. Museveni should not be president of Uganda. And we encourage the people of Uganda to use all legal and all non-violent means and ideas that they have to free themselves from the Museveni dictatorship.
Sandy Ismail, a supporter of Wine who managed to get into the compound, couldn't hide his excitement.
He
says, for me to believe, I had to first get in here. He says, that's when I believe that it's true. Our president has been released by those who were here holding him at home. What still pains me, says Sandy, is that they are still on the way as you get here. The police still maintain a roadblock on the way to Wine's home, with military and police patrol vehicles occasionally driving through the area. As Wine was speaking, a police helicopter was hovering over his house. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
He lost the presidency in a poll that he claims was rigged and marred by violence, but this head of state dropped his court battle to overturn the poll and is now enjoying a quiet retirement in his lakeside mansion. In an exclusive interview with Malawi's past immediate president, Peter Mutharika, viewer Anita Powell talks about how Southern Africa's poorest nation is facing political troubles and the continued onslaught of the coronavirus pandemic.
Peter Mutharika is certain he won re-election last June in a poll which he insists was rigged and which triggered violent protests. But instead of pursuing his case through the courts, he invited the new president and his wife over for a chat and some coffee. Landlocked Malawi is Southern Africa's poorest nation and was rocked by political protests over the June poll, which was a redo of a February poll that courts invalidated. But after months of protests and challenges, Mutharika folded and says he'll never run for office again.
I thought we needed peace in this country after 11 months of violence. So that's what happened. And I think my people, I'm so glad that they acted responsibly and accepted that we should go on, let them take the government, and let Malawi go on in peace.
President Lazarus Chakwera acknowledged broadly some of his shortcomings late last year, saying he accepted criticism for his handling of the pandemic and other pressing issues.
Have you done enough? No, I will be the first one to tell you I have not done enough. And this country has not done enough.
One thing Chakwera's government was quick to do shortly after taking office was to freeze Mutharika's bank accounts amid a corruption investigation. The former president is accused of taking part in a $6 million scheme to illegally import cement. When asked about it by VOA, Mutharika denied his involvement in the purchase. Mutharika, who remains leader of the opposition Democratic Progressive Party, called out his rival for what he sees as his biggest stumble, dealing with coronavirus. He said the government has failed to provide enough tests and economic assistance for citizens affected by viral restrictions.
They need to do more. We probably need some kind of lockdown at some point. We also need to have resources to assist those families in terms of food, nutrition.
The former president did note the government is encouraging the use of face masks and urging people to social distance, steps he said were good for the fight against COVID-19. The 80-year-old statesman added that he would not hesitate to take the vaccine when it arrives in Malawi, which has yet to happen. And finally, Mutharika says he's encouraged by political change in a major donor nation, the U.S.
I've already seen our President Biden reversing some of the things, going back to COP25, for example, and also getting United States back into the World Health Organization. So there are changes, and I assume that Africa, the previous government probably was not very active in Africa. I assume that perhaps the new government will be more active in Africa, as Democrats normally tend to do.
He did, however, offer some praise for the Trump administration, noting that Malawi was one of four countries that Melania Trump graced during her only tour of Africa in 2018. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Humanitarian operations are underway to provide life-saving assistance to tens of thousands of people in Mozambique, devastated by a tropical cyclone Eloid. At least six people reportedly have died, and more than 176,000 have been affected. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Tropical cyclone Eloise made landfall Saturday, dumping torrents of rain in areas already affected by tropical storm Charlene, which flooded large areas of Mozambique 3 weeks ago. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports 32 accommodation centers have been opened up in the heavily affected Sofala province. The centers are providing temporary shelter for more than 15,000 families. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says survivors of this destructive cyclone are in urgent need of food, tents, drinking water, mosquito nets, COVID-19 prevention materials, and other essential relief.
The cyclone destroyed, damaged, or flooded more than 8,800 houses in Mozambique, and at least 26 health centers have been damaged. Large areas of crops have been flooded, which raises concern for the annual harvest, which is expected in April. Again, these numbers may go up when we get more assessment results.
A recent analysis of the food and malnutrition situation in Mozambique indicates more than 2.9 million people face high levels of food insecurity in rural and urban areas in southern, central, and northern provinces. World Food Program spokesman Thompson Feary says his agency, along with the government and partners, is currently assessing the needs to have a full picture of the storm's impact.
Whilst the full extent of the need would be revealed once ongoing assessments have been concluded, early indications are that this storm has aggravated further the precarious food security situation in Sofala province. People need food assistance now to cope and will need support to re-establish their livelihoods going forward.
Aid agencies express concern about the extra level of danger posed by COVID-19. They say it is very difficult to maintain social distancing in displacement centers where people are in enclosed areas with little or no ventilation. The International Organization for Migration reports its staff is distributing soap and hygiene materials and a limited supply of cloth face masks to the most vulnerable, and encouraging people to do their best to keep their distance from others. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Somali Journalist Syndicate, SJS, a press freedom group, says at least 14 journalists have been arrested and the radio station attacked in the country in just 3 weeks. The group condemned the latest attacks on media organizations and their workers, which comes as Somalia prepares for parliamentary and presidential elections. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
The Somali Journalist Syndicate, a press freedom group, says at least 14 journalists have been arrested and a radio station attacked in the country in just 3 weeks. The group condemned the latest attacks on media organizations and their workers, which come as Somalia prepares for parliamentary and presidential elections. Since the beginning of this year, at least 14 journalists have been arrested across Somalia, either for airing views that upset local administrations or for reporting security incidents authorities wanted to keep quiet. Osman Awais Bahar is one of the arrested journalists. Southwest Federal State Security officers stormed his radio station in the town of Barawi, taking him into custody and pulling the FM station off the air. They arrested me because we air the opinions of the public complaining about the bad governance of Barayo town on the radio, Bahar says. I was in jail for 4 days, and the 4 days I was behind bars, the radio was off the air. I was released after elders intervened on the issue, but they told me to continue with my work and to stop airing the voices of those opposing the administration. On Wednesday last week, authorities in Galmudug Federal State arrested two journalists. Abdueli Jama, the director of the Office of President, told VOA that two reporters were arrested for sharing sensitive security details and the president's activities in Puntland State. Jama says these journalists have directly violated media laws and regulations that are preventing the journalists from interfering with the peace of the people, reporting on something that injures the peaceful existence of the people. He says if you check their social media pages, they reported something that has effects on the security of the region and its leaders, and this kind of reporting brings a lot of problems. The journalists were released the following day. The Somali Journalist Syndicate, which fights for the rights of journalists and free media, says it is worried about the rising number of detained journalists. Abdallah Ahmed Mu'min is the Secretary General of the organization. He says the upcoming elections are a key factor driving the arrests.
There are a lot of uncertainty surrounding this kind of election. Journalists are trying to get the news out and also to feed the information for the public interest. But unfortunately, the authorities do not want to see that. That's why you see they are targeting journalists, they are targeting local radio stations, including the radio in Beletwin.
Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's it for this Wednesday, January 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a great day.